Wright, good morning. Before you begin, we'd like to thank the council in both cases for accommodating our schedule this morning.
Good morning. May I please the court, Lisa Wright for Mr. Poynter. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Trial counsel Crawford was hired via the internet based on misrepresentations as to her criminal experience. Misrepresentations that, by the way, she continued to make to the prosecutor in the post-trial hearing and only came clean under oath after vigorous questioning from the district court judge. In fact, counsel had virtually no criminal experience or trial experience of any kind, and the record in this case sadly reveals that, in fact, she lacked the most basic understanding of the law of conspiracy, the law of entrapment, basic criminal procedure and evidentiary rules, and especially the hearsay rule. The record reveals that she provided ineffective assistance of counsel in four respects. First, she failed to understand that under this court's hearsay jurisprudence, the fact that law enforcement had been told that appellant had laundered money in the past was not admissible for background or for any other purpose with or without a limiting instruction. And this caused her to agree that such evidence should come in to her client's extreme detriment. Second, she failed to review Frank Smith's plea agreement and realized that he had waived his Fifth Amendment privilege and had agreed to testify if his testimony was, quote, deemed relevant by the government. That caused her to erroneously accept his assertion of the Fifth Amendment and the loss of his exculpatory testimony. Third, she failed to understand the hearsay rule in the other respect, in that it did allow in state of mind evidence, and it caused her to basically abandon, in several different respects, state-of-mind testimony, most extremely the threat that was stricken from the record that Mr. Poynter testified to. And fourth, she failed to seek an instruction on or argue the only defense that Mr. Poynter had, the defense that was raised by his testimony, and the jury was left with a misunderstanding of conspiracy law and a real likelihood that they convicted based on an understanding that the tapes revealed an agreement between Mr. Poynter and the informant, when in fact, of course, the informant could not be a conspirator. The jury, I don't think, could know that, because that's a fairly sophisticated thing, I think, to understand. As to the first argument, this court's cases in Evans and Williams, the counsel had an obligation to be familiar with those. Those are basic fundamental hearsay cases. This court could not have been more clear that background is not a justification. Yet, because she did not understand that, she affirmatively agreed to let this material in. The government argues this was some sort of strategic decision, but we know that it wasn't. The record reveals that it wasn't a strategy, because she did actually say and recognize that she did not want this information in, that it was prejudicial. She tried to keep it out. The problem was she didn't realize she was right, and she gave up on it, basically reached some sort of apparent compromise when there was no reason for her to compromise. The government's theories for why she might have wanted the jury to hear these out-of-court accusations that defendant had a propensity to launder money, they simply don't make any sense. The impeachment that she did of Jerome Thomas, the informant, had no relation to the substance of the tip. She would have and could have done all that impeachment without the information from the tip. The tip was simply another hurdle that she had to overcome with the same impeachment that she would have done anyway. So in no way, there's just no theory under which it helped her. So the record alone establishes the prejudice.
What came in under that heading?
I'm sorry?
What came in as a result?
The testimony that that Jerome Thomas had reported to law enforcement that he would be willing to launder, that Poynter was someone who was willing to launder money. So essentially, the jury learned that here's somebody with propensity to launder money whose testimony is, I was afraid, was just placating him and telling him what he wanted to hear, creating the ambiance. When, you know, that, given that the jury then, it's exactly like the Evans case where the jury was told that this person had a history of drug dealing, and then the government puts that in for the background of why they tried to do a controlled buy with him. The government, you know, also tries to argue that there was no prejudice because it's clear from the tapes that Mr. Poynter does know about money laundering. But I guess we would say that there's a difference between knowing and doing, a big difference. I mean, a lot of us know how to launder money, but we don't launder money. And the tip here was that he had a history of laundering money or was willing to launder money. As to the failure to review the Smith plea agreement, we disagree with the government. They argue that there would have been perjury exposure, and that's why he still had a Fifth Amendment privilege. But his testimony at the post-trial hearing was not inconsistent with his plea. As we discussed in the reply brief, I think he did say, Mr. Poynter introduced us. I don't know if that's conspiracy or not. He didn't walk away from his plea at all. But he did give testimony that would have buttressed Mr. Poynter's testimony. And the statement of offense, that was drafted by the government required Mr. Smith to agree to several things that he had no way of knowing, or in one case, an outright false statement. So I don't think those sorts of things could be perjury exposure. On the issue about the failure to understand the hearsay rule, she didn't understand the state of mind exception at all, and she did not object when the court repeatedly kept things out as hearsay, and she, I think, not understanding it, it's pretty clear she got sort of beaten down by that. She didn't understand, and when Mr. Poynter himself testified that Mr. Thomas's uncle threatened to come and send his nephews to come get me or get you, that was stricken to disregard. And in fact, that was probably the most important statement for Mr. Poynter in the whole thing, because without a threat from Mr. Ayers, there's no reason to fear the nephew. It was the crux of the whole defense. And when that was stricken, any other lawyer would have stood up and gone up to the bench and said, Your Honor, we offer this for state of mind, not for the truth of the matter. And as the government, I think, concedes in their brief, that it wasn't actually hearsay. Likewise, Officer Jeter testified post-trial that the defendant was afraid for his life, told him he was afraid for his life, and he confirmed that he came to offer security and protection. He was a police officer. Mr. Poynter did testify that he called a police officer in, but that's a lot different when the officer himself gets up and says, yes, he told me he was afraid and I came and protected him. Fourth, on her failure to seek an instruction on or argue the defense, she acknowledged post-trial that there was no entrapment defense. She basically didn't understand entrapment, so she tries to present this entrapment defense or has some vague idea that she's going to do this. It doesn't pan out. She acknowledged it didn't pan out. By the time of closing, she knew it wouldn't. The judge wouldn't give the instruction. So her client has gotten up and testified very plainly to what his defense is, which is that I did not intend to conspire. I did not intend to launder money. I was afraid, and I was going along and basically pretending. That was his defense. She did not argue that defense at all, nor did she request a jury instruction that would have explained to the jury that Thomas could not conspire. Therefore, the only way for there to be conspiracy is for the jury to believe that he conspired either with Smith or Cook or both. And that was not done.
When the defendant got up and supplied what counsel, you say, had failed to supply, did that fill the gap?
No, because, certainly the jury did not get proper instructions, and we cite some cases where there was a failure to give that sort of instruction about a government agent not being capable of conspiring, and that is the kind of thing that the jury was entitled to hear here, and she failed to ask for it, or probably even understand it, I think. And as a result, the jury, if you listen to the tapes, it does sound like they're conspiring to launder money. He and Jerome Thomas. And if the jury doesn't know that that's not a conspiracy, and the indictment alleges that Smith, Cook, Poynter, and other persons known and unknown to the grand jury conspired, there's every reason to think the jury could have said, well, we don't know whether he was really conspiring with Smith or Cook, but we know he was conspiring with, and of course, in conjunction with these other errors.
You say that because of the strength of the evidence that was introduced and that could be used in support or to create the impression that the conspiracy was with Thomas.
The conspiracy was with Thomas.
But there's evidence suggesting the conspiracy between Poynter and the others as well.
There was, certainly.
And it's much of it is unrecorded.
Yes. Well, I don't know that there's a lot. Well, there's some recordings where I guess both Mr. Smith and Mr. Poynter are in the room during the conversation. And I guess the original one, Mr. Cook, was there. But again, Mr. Poynter's testimony was that he was going along and creating this ambiance for Thomas, and he was afraid and didn't want to cross him, didn't want to make him mad. And that was essentially what was happening. And the jury, you know, they weren't given the evidence. They were given evidence they shouldn't have heard about his propensity to launder money, and they weren't given evidence about to support Mr. Poynter's state of mind, his fearfulness, and this threat. Without any of that, his defense, his testimony was really fairly useless. And then when she fails to argue it even, or argue there's a reasonable doubt, she gives a four-page closing argument, which is sort of a stream of consciousness of stuff that, frankly, is not a defense. There is no, she presented no defense. She argued no reasonable doubt. I mean, it's rare that a client testifies. When the client testifies, you need to get up and argue if you have nothing else. And I admit that if she'd had some defense that she thought was better than his testimony, it was within her professional judgment to argue that instead. But that's not what happened, because she had no other defense. She admitted that her, quote, entrapment idea didn't pan out.
But the jury heard the law enforcement officer who provided protection, right?
Officer Jeter did not testify.
No. All right, did the jury hear, was the conversation between Poynter and Cook when Poynter said, how do you want to do this with this money? And Cook said, it's mine. And he gave him $100 for lunch, mm-hmm. or something like that. That was recorded, right?
Yes, and that was Smith, yes, and that
right.
was recorded. All right,
and then how about the one with, Cook? I thought Smith was the post office and Cook was the...
Vice versa.
Okay. All right. Well, did the jury hear, in addition, the post office, when Poynter went in the car with the other three, and then the three of them went into the, I guess they went into the bank or the post office.
Poynter was not present for any of the money laundering. He didn't participate in any of the postal run or any of the bank runs. It was based solely on this idea that he was a behind-the-scenes kingpin.
Right.
There were some recorded conversations where Cook was present. There were some recorded conversations where Smith was present, and we don't dispute that those conversations are subject to the interpretation that they're conspiring. But that's his testimony rebutted that. The government says, well, the jury rejected his innocent explanations. But that's our point. They rejected it. They didn't hear everything they should have heard, and they heard some things they shouldn't have heard. And if the trial had been conducted by someone who knew, you know, basic criminal procedure, basic conspiracy law.
They did hear Poynter say, I did this under duress, right?
The best thing he said for his defense is the thing that got stricken, which is the uncle came and threatened me to send his nephews to come get me. That statement was stricken. Without that, it was a little unclear. It was unclear to the jury why he would have feared or been humoring the nephew.
Well, what did he say? Once that was stricken, what was the jury allowed to consider as far as duress?
Well, it wasn't really a duress defense. He was arguing he didn't intend to conspire, but unfortunately his story didn't make a lot of sense without the threat, because why would you pretend to be willing to launder money for someone and, you know, introduce them, send them up to Frank Smith? Why would, you know, Mr. Poynter tried to explain, well, I was just trying to get him out of my office. I was just trying to get away from him. But having had that critical threat stricken, it just didn't make a lot of sense.
Didn't he also say it was all a joke?
He said, I was joking. I think that was part of this whole sort of like, I'm just pretending. I'm going along. I'm humoring him. We're just talking. I didn't mean it. That was a lot of different things like that were said. He certainly said everything except for the threat. But the problem was, you know, there was corroborating information that was kept out, and then, of course, the jury didn't understand the law. So,
That Poynter testified that Ayers took out a gun. Am I right that was
his testimony? He did say that. That's
so
true.
Wouldn't the jury have thought of that as a threat?
That is true. I was forgetting about the gun. The gun testimony, you know, there was not actually a link made. It was a little odd the way it was said, to be honest. But he did say that a gun was displayed in his office. But, you know, he didn't. I mean, I think the threat saying, I'm going to send my nephew to get you, without that, it doesn't make, really, the whole theory just didn't make any sense, you know, unfortunately. But that's what happened. I'd like to reserve, if I can, for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Perez.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's James Perez on behalf of the government. May it please the court. Your Honors, out of the four ineffective assistant counsel claims that appellant now raises on appeal, only one of them was raised at the post-trial hearing. Appellant was represented by new counsel at the post-trial hearing. The post-trial hearing took place about a year after appellant's guilty finding. And appellant raised at least four different claims at the post-trial hearing. He only raised one claim that he's currently raising on appeal. Under this court's case law, starting with DeBango, we think that the appellant has waived these three tardy new claims on appeal.
Well, what we've said, though, is that that's a waiver unless we can tell from the record.
That's
either that, you know, it was or was not a problem.
That's correct, Your Honor. DeBango does not make that point. However, Fennell and Askew, which follows DeBango, do make that point. It's our position, however, that the three new claims that have been raised on appeal cannot conclusively be shown on this record that appellant's trial counsel was ineffective. Starting with the first, so unhappy with the result of the post-trial hearing in which the trial court allowed the defendant with new counsel to present five different witnesses, including his own testimony, now the appellant wants to raise three entirely new claims, and we just don't think, based on this record, that he can sustain an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Starting with the threats statements that was excluded from the trial court, we think that the threats that that appellant testified to that his uncle Mr. Thomas's uncle James Eyre made that was improperly, concededly we admit, was improperly excluded as hearsay evidence. We don't think that that was at all essential to the defendant's defense, which was essentially that I was joking, I was playing around, we were pretending. He states at one point, what you have here is just three guys sitting here drinking and smoking, and all this was a joke. Never did he claim that the reason I was joking, the reason I was pretending around for literally 9 months or so during the span of this conspiracy was because I was afraid of Mr. Ayers or Mr. Thomas, the informant. He never claims that, and he could have claimed that if he wanted to. He does not. Nowhere in the record does appellant's counsel on appeal point to in which the appellant tried to make that assertion. So what we have is one single threat that was excluded from the record, but in face of all the other, all the other evidence that was in the trial, I don't think that at the end of the day that this caused the defendant any prejudice. To the extent that appellant had a purpose for the threat information from Mr. Ayers, there was other evidence in the record that Mr. Ayers had threatened the appellant. Your Honor, Judge Brown pointed out, Mr. Ayers not only made a threat, he pulled out a gun at one particular point and threatened the appellant with the gun. That's a lot stronger than this just words threat that was excluded from the trial court at trial. At one particular point, the appellant testified that, you know, at the very initial meeting, the very first meeting on November the 18th, 2005, that he was worried about Mr. Thomas coming to his office, and that's why he asked Chris Cook to sit in the meeting at the office on November 18th. I think all that information gave the jury enough information, all that testimony gave the jury enough information to believe that the appellant was afraid of Mr. Thomas and Mr. Ayers. But again, we don't think that was essential to his defense.
Let me ask you about the concern that counsel expressed about the hearsay that came in, which she says is the only evidence of any prior proclivity by Mr. Poynter to be involved.
Yes, Your Honor. I think on this record, again, that claim was not raised below. But on this record, I think that unlike Williams, here we can tell from the record, we can make an inference from the record that the appellant's counsel, trial counsel, had a strategy in using this information. It may not have been a successful strategy. Strickland doesn't require that to be a successful strategy, but she did affirmatively use the temp information to show that it wasn't a tip that Mr. Thomas received that motivated him to contact the special agent Sawkins to initiate this investigation, that in fact it was this bias that Mr. Thomas had because of this sour business relationship that Mr. Thomas and Mr. Ayers, the informant's uncle, had. So I think that on this record, the court can make an inference that there was a strategy that trial counsel had. And again, it may not have been a successful one, but that's besides the point. We don't look, Strickland doesn't require, in fact, Strickland requires us not to look in hindsight. So that distinguished this case from Williams. And Williams, there was nothing on the record in Williams that trial counsel had a strategy involving this purported propensity hearsay information. It's trial counsel in Williams was simply silent. But the point is, even in Williams, the court said, well, this is not per se ineffectiveness. We have to send it back down for yet another hearing. For the reasons already stated, we don't think that that appellant is entitled to another hearing. Now, appellant's counsel today says, well, she could have made this bias point without the tip of information. And that's true. She could have made the bias point without the tip of information just by referring to the fact that Mr. Thomas, the government's former uncle, James Eyre, and the appellant had a business relationship that went bad. But the point is that the tip information allowed defense counsel to insinuate that Mr. Thomas was not being truthful with the jury as to what was his motivation, what was his true motivation. And that was a strong, powerful point. I think at the end of the day, defense counsel here had very little to work with. She testified post-trial that this was a very strong case and that she advised appellant that this was a very strong case, and the district court credit her on that point. She had very little to work with, and she tried to make the best out of whatever evidence that she could. And this tip information was just another leeway for her to somewhat discredit the government's pretty much main witness, although I would argue that the main witness was really the audio and videotapes of these meetings. Mm-hmm. Even if the tip information was somewhat prejudiced, or there was not a strategy that can be inferred from on this record, we think that the tip information, which really was only mentioned one time in Jerome Thomas, the informant's testimony, we think that at the end of the day, it caused no prejudice, because at the very first meeting on November 18, 2005, the appellant says, he's heard recorded on recording saying, I try to deal with stuff where if it's not legal, I try to make it legal. Now, that's different from what appellant counsel is claiming on appeal, that just shows some type of knowledge of money laundering. What he says is, I tried in past tense to deal with stuff. If it's not legal, I try to make it look legal. That's the definition of money laundering. So we think that at the end of the day, even if this tip information did not come in under a reasonable trial strategy on trial counsel's part, that it caused no prejudice to him. If I may just briefly address the Frank Smith's Fifth Amendment waiver, I think the clearest way to discard of this argument is that it is clear from the record that Frank Smith's post-trial testimony would not have been helpful at all to the appellant at trial. Frank Smith testified that the appellant introduced Frank Smith to the informant as well as the government agent, and that he knew what it was for. That's totally inconsistent with the appellant's defense at trial, which was, I was only joking and pretending to play along. Well, Frank Smith rebuts that testimony, rebuts that testimony as post-trial testimony. And I think it's significant that even on appeal, appellate has not pointed to any helpful testimony that Frank Smith would have given at the trial. So we don't think that argument warrants a new trial for appellant. And finally, Your Honors, with the little time that I have left, I would just like to briefly talk about the conspiracy instruction that was not given. Again, this was no dispute at trial that the government informant was part of this conspiracy. No one argued that at trial. Appellant points to cases in which trial counsel had made a request, it probably could have been given. However, that's not the question. The question is, why didn't she make that request? And I think that on this record it's clear she didn't make the request because this was not disputed. At the beginning of the government's closing argument, the government stated that this conspiracy is between Frank Smith, Chris Cook, and the appellant. And at the very last word that the government, before it sat down and before the case went to the jury, the government said that this conspiracy is between Christopher Cook, Frank Smith, and the appellant. Finally, again, this was a very overwhelming case. We think that the audio and video evidence left no doubt in the jury's mind, and that at the end of the day, trial counsel did the very best that she can do with what she had. If there's no further questions, I ask that the judgment of the Superior Court be affirmed.
All right, thank you. Let's see, Ms. Wright, does Ms. Wright have any time?
Ms. Wright doesn't have any time.
All right, why don't you take a minute?
Thank you. On the point about whether there had been a link made by the defendant about between his fear and his actions or his pretending, the government, I think, is trying to have it both ways, because they say we don't point to the record evidence that he was afraid, but then they say, but in any way, there was plenty of evidence that he was afraid. And there was plenty of evidence he was afraid. But the problem, he didn't, as far as why he didn't say, you know, once the evidence about the nephew's going to come get me has been stricken, you can't really say to him, now, Mr. Poynter, you know, he can't say, well, remember that threat that was stricken, that's why. You know, you can't really make the link if the premise of it has been kept out. I still do not understand, you know, the government's theory of how money laundering propensity could possibly have helped Mr. Poynter, because really they say, well, she was trying to show that Mr. Thomas was motivated to start this whole thing by this bias, but really it doesn't matter why Mr. Thomas. It's not a defense that Mr. Thomas was motivated by bias. It's not entrapment, so it isn't a defense. And the government really, again, has it backwards, because the only reason she's talking about, though he's a legitimate businessman and they're picking on a legitimate businessman, is because she was trying to rebut this improper thing that had come in, that he was corrupt from the beginning. That never would have come up if she, I mean, certainly no defense lawyer in their right mind would have brought it up and opened the door to such a thing. She only did it as a defensive tactic. And finally, the government quotes him saying things like, I try to make it legal, and I've sort of suggesting I've money laundered in the past. And we certainly don't dispute that. Part of his pretending was pretending to be this knowledgeable, experienced money launderer. So that's not a problem for us. And Frank Smith, to the extent they say Frank Smith couldn't help, the government's whole theory was that Frank Smith was taking orders from Mr. Poynter, and Frank Smith, and he was the kingpin, and the reason he was a behind-the-scenes mastermind. Frank Smith's testimony is completely inconsistent with that. He said, as he simply introduced me, I did everything on my own. He knew, but he didn't want any part of it, or he wasn't any part of it. So I thank Your Honor and ask for you to reverse and grant a new trial. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.